Chapter 35. A Home for the Jews. Rarely had voters indicated so clearly to an elected official why they had given him their votes. The neutrality issue crossed party lines. The Republican platform had demanded that Wilson guarantee neutrality. After several months of standing firm, Wilson was gradually being softened up by the relentless House. House regarded neutrality as a stratagem to enter war, and Wilson was a horse to be ridden into battle. "The president," said House with some arrogance, "can modify his views. As I have said before, he often and easily changes his mind." The contrast between Wilson and House over neutrality was uneven. Wilson was rather honest, but his mind was like a wet sponge, easily manipulated. House, the honorary Texas colonel, was power-hungry and deceitful. He knew the American people would never have elected him, and he made it his business to pull all the strings behind the scenes, behind Wilson. Wilson tried to respect his election commitment, but House never let up. The tug of war would go on for months, like the plot of some detective novel. Wilson was disappointed with the Allies. They did not want peace, they had imperialist designs, they did not share his vision for a better world. He had reached the conclusion that neither the Germans, whom he did not like, nor the Allies, whom he distrusted, were worth a war. America would not join the massacre for their sake. House, on the other hand, was committed to British interests and was committed to deliver America to fight a British war. Wilson and House were no longer of one mind or one another's alter ego. In fact, House set out to undermine Wilson's moves for peace. "I did all I could to stop Wilson from launching another peace offensive without first having received the Allies' consent." Letter to Seymour. House later commented that Wilson's peace proposals were offending the Allies. House, 2, 431. Rebuffed by the Allies, Wilson now wanted to reach European public opinion directly and create popular peace movements among all the belligerents. House immediately told Wilson, "The Allies would interpret such a project as inimical." Wilson did not want to appear hostile, so he dropped his plan. Instead, he asked House to go to Europe once more. House said no, it would take too much time and I would have to struggle with all sorts of unfavorable arguments. None of them could ignore that I was there to talk peace, and I would rather go to the kingdom of hell than visit these countries with such a mission. House, 2, 433. Wilson was somewhat taken aback. His alter ego preferred hell to peace. When Wilson stated that the matter of submarine warfare and its attendant international laws should be settled without any further delay, House replied he could see no reason to pull the chestnuts out of the fire for Germany. Wilson decided to send a message to all the countries at war as well as the American people. He wrote it himself and showed it to House, who immediately was critical of its content. "I dread the reaction it will provoke. The phrase, 'The causes and objectives of this war are obscure,' raises strong objections." In his secret notes, House complained, "Each time he, Wilson, talks about the war, he offends the Allies." House, 2, 436. The offending phrase was nevertheless correct. The war had been prepared in secrecy, with lies and provocations. Its aims and objectives had been carefully obscured by the schemers who had set it in motion. Perhaps without realizing it, Wilson was directing the spotlight on a crime. House could not countenance such a suggestion and put on a performance for a change of phraseology. "I begged him, Wilson, to modify the text I criticized and to replace it with something which would allow the Allies to believe the president sympathized with them." House, 2, 437. House wanted the president to perform a kind of dialectical somersault. His quest for peace had somehow to convey to the Allies that he really did not want it. "I suggested the insertion of a clause specifying he did not have the pretension to interfere or demand peace." Jusserat, the French ambassador in Washington, also spoke for the British when he stated, "The Western Front is in all likelihood condemned to stagnate for at least a year and perhaps more." It was a war of attrition which the British were in no hurry to stop, while the thousand-year-old fabric of European civilization was being torn apart. The outcome of the differences between House and Wilson would be profoundly affected by the intervention of certain Jewish personalities, as well as by Lloyd George, an ardent war advocate. Lloyd George's first announcement was of a policy based on the knockout principle, which would exclude any possibility of negotiations with Germany, House, 2, 440. This was the same Lloyd George who less than 20 years later would go to Berchtesgaden to salute with warmth and admiration the new Chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler. Sir Edward Grey was also replaced by the Jewish peer, Lord Balfour, while another Jew, Sonnino, had been made Foreign Minister of Italy. In the United States, Jewish financier Bernard Baruch had enlarged his influence within the administration. French Premier Georges Clemenceau's equivalent of House was the Jew Georges Mandel, known legally as Jeroboam Rothschild, and his financial advisor was another Jew called Klotz, who was appointed Finance Minister of France. Years later Klotz would end up in jail as a convicted swindler. House was delighted with all the changes. Balfour would make it his personal business to change American public opinion. In 1916 he came to the United States to lay the groundwork among financial and press circles. In 1917 he made his famous Balfour Declaration, which was to bring about one of the greatest revolutions in the world. The declaration appeared quite innocuous. It granted to the Jews of the world a home in Palestine. The Jews would not interfere with the existing inhabitants of Palestine, the Palestinians. The Palestinian way of life and property would be respected, and there was not the slightest hint of expanding the home for the Jews at the expense of the Palestinians. Balfour's plan raised concern in many countries. It created a precedent for other peoples to claim a home in a land they may have inhabited as far back as 2,000 years ago. The precedent would open the door for many to claim land they had lived in far more recently. Balfour was quick to put the lid on the whole issue with the help of Jewish-controlled newspapers and international news agencies. He reasoned that issues are raised by the press, not people, and if the press did not debate his plan, no one would question it. Those who did were never reported. Balfour believed in the sacred duty of the press to manipulate the many for the benefit of the few. He chose America to implement this policy. At the beginning of the war, the majority of Jews had been favorable to Germany. Tsarist Russia, their mortal enemy, had been attacked by Germany, and the Kaiser was looked upon as the man who would deliver Palestine as a home for the Jews. Although there had been occasional violent reactions against them, it was in Germany they felt most at ease. They had acquired enormous influence in finance and business, in the news media, and the universities. They regarded their own language of Yiddish as akin to German, and they liked to be involved in German culture. Kaiser Wilhelm treated them with deference. The richest man in Germany was a Jew named Albert Ballin, who was an advisor to the Kaiser. The most influential members of the Reichstag were Jews. British Jews thought highly of the Kaiser. Lord Rothschild sent a cable wishing the Kaiser well when the war broke out. American Jews were just as favorable to Germany, as the war coverage of the Jewish-controlled press in 1914 and 1915 will testify. When Balfour came to the United States in 1916, he was amazed at the strength of the Jewish lobby and Jewish influence in finance, politics, and the press. Balfour was satisfied the Jews could direct the country in any way they pleased. It was his task to harness and direct this tremendous power for the benefit of his British associates. Certain events had made a reorientation of Jewish loyalties necessary. By 1917, Tsarist Russia had been destroyed, and it looked as if the Kaiser's Turkish allies would prevent him from delivering Palestine to the Jews. As far as Balfour was concerned, Germany had outlived its usefulness, and any Jewish loyalty to it was totally out of date. The British were now to hand over Palestine after Balfour and House helped them win the war by bringing America to their side. It was a simple deal: the Jews would bring America into the war, thus ensuring a British victory. For this service, Great Britain would make Palestine a home for the Jews. Balfour had yet to convince American Jewry. He had to make them change sides almost overnight. The most eloquent and persuasive advocates of Zionism were enlisted to tell American Jews that their dream of a return to Jerusalem was about to be realized after 2,000 long years. It was an emotional appeal designed to bring American Jewry to the side of the Entente. Balfour and his agents were successful beyond all expectation. American Jewry switched over to the side of the Allies in 1917. Jewish financial and press networks were now placed at the disposal of the Allied war effort. After the war, Balfour explained his promises were only in his mind, just so many propaganda slogans to promote whatever he was trying to do at the time. The Jews he had convinced did not see them that way. The Balfour Declaration was a time bomb bringing war and destruction throughout the course of the 20th century. The British government was informed by House of the Wilson administration's every move. House, backed by the full power of American Jewry, was in virtual control of America. In turn, the British were in control of House. He took his orders from London and acted as a kind of unofficial British viceroy of the United States. The new order left Wilson weaker and more isolated than ever. He had become withdrawn and no longer made any attempt to confer with House on the subject of peace. In the eyes of the new power brokers, President Wilson was just a figurehead and was treated as such. This development greatly concerned the Germans. On December 12, 1916, the German government declared itself ready to talk peace with all of its adversaries. The Germans were hoping Wilson, now that he was taken at his word, could somehow influence the Allies to sit down at the peace table. They soon found out the president was in no position to wield such influence. The British establishment had sent a high-level agent, Sir William Wiseman, to Washington. His job was to instruct House of London's requirements. The German peace call got short shrift. Wiseman informed House, "It is impossible to negotiate with the Germans since they did not specify any conditions." The British answer was quite dishonest since conditions are discussed at the negotiating table, not before. Again, the president was left out by the British, who communicated with House as the unofficial head of state of America. In London, U.S. Ambassador Page immediately informed the British government that Wilson was not in the least interested in the German peace call. It was an outright lie which Seymour deplored. "Mr. Page has so little sympathy with Mr. Wilson's policy that he gave the British to understand the American administration would not take the German appeal seriously." House, 2, 445. In fact, Wilson wrote a note all by himself and for the first time in his life did not show it to House. He appealed to both the Allies and Germany to exchange views. The belligerents each insist on certain conditions. They are not incompatible, contrary to the fear of certain persons. An exchange of views would clear the air. This was exactly what the Germans wanted and the Allies rejected. When House read the note after it had been sent, he moaned, "These words will enrage the Allies." He formally disassociated himself with the entire content of Wilson's note because the Allies were obviously not in a mood to welcome it. The statement indicated that House was more concerned with the Allies' mood than the interests of America. The Germans answered Wilson at once, "A direct exchange of views was the best way to reach peace. Germany renews its call for a conference." House, 2, 449. The Allies would come to a conference only if the Germans were defeated and chained. This was the gist of their reply to Wilson. Both Wilson and Germany had failed in all their peace initiatives. There was no longer any reason for the Germans to restrain their submarines. The people were about to revolt. They could no longer endure the famine and demanded the breaking of the British blockade. Already more than 100,000 workers had gone on strike in Berlin, closing down strategic factories. One-third of German deputies were socialists opposed to the military. As in St. Petersburg, they called on the people to revolt. Germany was faced with choosing between famine and revolution on one hand, or hurting the feelings of American officials on the other. Wilson's Secretary of State, Lansing, was aware of Germany's dilemma when he concluded on December 21, 1916, "We are on the eve of war." House and the British lobby were concerned that Wilson might still thwart their war plans. House sounded the alarm in a number of notes. "X is very concerned, he believes Wilson wants peace at any price, January 2, 1917. Why is quite downcast? According to him, the president has lost his nerve, January 4, 1917. House's fears were realized on January 22, 1917, when Wilson addressed the Senate, "We must reach a peace without victory. Peace must be based on the right of each nation to decide its own destiny without the intervention of a more powerful external enemy." The speech reflected American public opinion but profoundly upset Britain. Herbert Hoover, although he was anti-German, backed the president. Wilson expressed what many people thought and waited for someone with the courage to proclaim. The future American president then asked Wilson, "The next step is to ask all belligerents whether they accept the principles expressed in your speech. If they don't, what are their objections? If they agree, it will be fitting for you to convoke them in a conference." Wiseman, Balfour's liaison man with House in Washington, conveyed the British reaction, "By insisting too much on peace among the Allies, you, the Americans, are doing great harm to the cause of democracy," House 2,465. "Deep resentment against Wilson," wrote House. "The Allied press keeps referring to his unfortunate mention of peace without victory. Everybody sees a contradiction on our part in wanting Germany to escape punishment." House never stopped agitating for war. On January 25, 1917, he urged Wilson, "If I were you, I would be cautious enough to hasten the state of readiness of the Navy and the Army." On January 30, after the Allied failure to answer Wilson's last peace call, the German ambassador announced that Germany had now decided to break the British blockade regardless of American reaction. The German forces were in good position on both East and Western fronts. Russia, attacked from within and without, was about to collapse. This meant a million German soldiers could be brought back to the Western Front. Further, the defeated Russia would supply Germany with all the wheat and meat it wanted, which in those days Russia had in abundance. The German government hoped to offset the impact of the British blockade and perhaps ward off an American intervention. Unfortunately for Germany, Tsarist Russia would stagger on for another 2 months. Manifests of German ships were published in order to warn American travelers of potential dangers, in still another attempt to avoid American involvement. The British did not reciprocate but instead increased their acts of piracy. Wilson was appalled, "I feel as if the planet is suddenly rotating the other way, after going from east to west it is now going from west to east. I have lost my balance." The Kaiser left the door open for a reversal of the submarine decision. The president succeeded in laying acceptable grounds for peace. He also promised to safeguard American interests to the best of his ability. Wilson countered by reaffirming, "We do not wish to help selfish aims," which seemed more directed against the Allies than Germany. House kept a close watch on Wilson. He, the president, moved his books around the desk nervously. He walked up and down the room. "We were painfully killing time, there was nothing left to say. Finally, the president suggested we play billiards." House and the British lobby intensified their pressure on Wilson to break for diplomatic relations with Germany. After agonizing for 3 days, Wilson finally yielded and agreed to inform Congress that relations were now broken with the Reich. Even then, Wilson still clung to rays of hope. The president still refused to admit that a diplomatic break automatically means war. For House and his associates, it most definitely meant war. "The break in diplomatic relations will lead to war ipso facto," House 2,484. Wilson was very ill at ease. He feared public reaction. Industrialist Henry Ford had told him, "I have not met, between New York and San Francisco, a single man who wanted war." Although the German ambassador was officially expelled, Wilson allowed him to stay another 2 weeks. He was still in Washington when the Swiss ambassador, representing German interests, entered negotiations to re-establish relations between Washington and Berlin. House was alarmed, high officials at state fear Wilson might weaken. The return of German submarines, however, staved off House's anxiety. It was the only thing that would change American opinion. If the Germans were to succeed, they had to hit hard and win the sea war quickly within 6 months. They had worked out that their 150 submarines would sink 3 million tons of shipping during that period, one-third of the British merchant navy. This would also frighten neutral countries away from exporting goods to Britain. Exports of wool from Australia, cotton from America and wheat from Canada and Argentina would be stopped. American intervention would come too late to save London. The submarines resumed combat duty on February 1, 1917. By the end of the month, 540,000 tons of British vessels had been sunk. By April, the figure would reach 874,000 tons. The French historian Renouvin wrote, "It is estimated that a steamship on the Gibraltar-London route would have one chance in four of not making it home. Great Britain is therefore in the process of losing at an alarming rate its best merchant ships, those bringing wheat from Canada and Australia, raw material from the United States, and meat from South America." The German plan had succeeded beyond expectations. Britain was losing on land and sea. The British Admiralty brass was running scared. If the losses incurred during the second week of April continue at the same level in the following weeks, it will be impossible to ensure the supplies of the British Isles. Britain might be forced to capitulate. Renouvin, La Crise Européenne, 441. General Robertson, chief of the British General Staff, informed Field Marshal Haig on April 26, 1917, "The maritime situation has never been worse than now." Jellicoe, commanding officer of the British Navy, says almost daily things are desperate. The Tsar of Russia was overthrown on March 15, 1917. The British were massacred in the Battle of Artois on April 6, and the French experienced a similar fate in Champagne on April 16. The Allies were reeling. Admiral Holzendorf's promise in January to bring Great Britain to heel before the end of August is about to be realized. Renouvin, La Crise Européenne, 411. The German Navy gave the British a taste of their own medicine. They did not like it, and like the proverbial bully cried foul. The American press was now all ears to British wailing and waxed emotional over British-American kinship. The pro-British interventionists got a tremendous boost when big business weighed in on their side. American exports to Britain came to a grinding halt. The arms merchants, the cotton and wheat traders, could no longer transport their wares. They were hit in the pocketbook. Overnight, Germany became the enemy, regardless of the rights and wrongs of the conflict. Professor Renouvin states, "Britain and its allies accounted for three-quarters of American exports. Within days, American ports were piled with goods which ships were no longer loading. The resulting losses were not only hurting the arms manufacturers and big business on the East Coast, but industries in Ohio, Midwestern farmers, and cotton growers in the South. The whole nation felt the pinch and many minds were changed. Germany was to blame, German submarines had become intolerable." In the same way, the banks joined the pro-war side. They had lent billions of dollars to the Allies, 19 times more than they had lent to Germany, and they lived in dread of a German victory. Who would repay the multi-billion dollar loans if the Allies were defeated? For the bankers, it was imperative that their debtors win. The Balfour Declaration had influenced the American press to switch to a pro-war policy. Many publishers were Jews, and the Allies' war now became their war for Jerusalem. They felt Jerusalem was well worth a war, America owed it to them. Wilson was just at the end of his tether. He was besieged by all the interests fanning the flames of war. He was stigmatized for being humiliated by German submarines and betraying national honor. The pro-war coalition was now moving to force the president's hand. On February 7, the State Department told the arms dealers to defend themselves by any useful means. Wilson was pressured to endorse in Congress a demand giving him the power to arm merchant vessels. Such vessels would force German submarines to attack or be sunk as soon as they appeared. After 4 days of debate, the House approved the motion. The Senate resisted for another 10 days as 12 senators highly critical of the motion filibustered. Wilson accused the senators of reducing the great government of the United States to ridiculous impotence. Since he could not obtain confirmation in the Senate, Wilson issued a presidential decree authorizing the conversion of merchant ships into de facto warships. As expected, a number of American ships were torpedoed, among them the Algonquin and the Villagentia. Yet even after these sinkings, the American people, as distinct from the pro-war special interest groups, did not let themselves be carried away. House complained bitterly, "In Missouri they don't seem to understand what's at stake. That's the pathetic side of this business." House found it incomprehensible and pathetic that Middle America would not rush enthusiastically into a blaze of bullets, bombs, and shells. The pro-war coalition created a way to turn the American people, those who had to do the fighting, into determined foes of the Germans. The surefire plan was known as the Zimmerman Telegram Affair.